Welcome in to Locked On Knicks. I am your host, Alex Wolf, along with your co-host, Gavin Shaw. We're here to take on part two of the mailbag today. It was supposed to just be one, but, you know, we had such a good time on the first one. We decided to make it into two episodes for you guys because, you know, bigger is better, all that. So today, we're going to answer a number of questions, more than our first one, because the first one got a little beefy. But in the first segment, we're going to break down whether the Knicks can find a trading partner for Enes Kanter and whether Kevin Knox and Kristaps Porzingis can be a rebounding front court that could win a championship, amongst other things.
And then we're going to finish this one off with a couple of intriguing would-you-rathers. Knox and Burke versus Vonleh and Trier. And then we're going to tell you whether or not the Knicks are tanking. And finally, we'll give you some thoughts on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Pretty easily the most important of our questions on the day.
All that and more next on Locked On Knicks.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Knox foul from behind, counting and one. As Fisdale pumps his fist.
Milikina.
What he does is contagious, like.
To Trier. Trier drives. Oh! Alonzo Trier. And across the lane. To Porzingis. Fires up a three and boom! That one goes down and the game is tied.
Becomes infectious.
So, Gavin, we've got some good questions again coming up here for the second mailbag episode. First one, I feel like this won't be necessarily the longest question in the world, but we'll see. Do you see the Knicks finding a trade for Enes Kanter before the deadline, or is that not possible? This is from Andrew Weiss, who is at Weissman08 on Twitter.
What a handle. Do you think he was on? I think Twitter started in 09, so I wonder what prompted him to pick 08. And if he was born in 2008, that's just an impressive question from an 11-year-old. So shout out, probably 10, actually. So shout out to you, Andrew, even if you're older than that. The reason I spent time talking about his handle is I think it's more interesting than the question. I think you set me straight on this issue, Alex, because two podcasts ago, we were talking about Enes's kind of sort of pseudo asking for a trade without asking for a trade, maybe not asking for a trade, however you wanted to interpret that in his meeting with Scott Perry. But I was kind of the opinion initially. I was like, well, you know what? There are some teams that can kind of use him. But just from a cap perspective, I think you did a really good job laying out why that's not totally feasible. And I, after listening to you talk about it and educate me a little bit, I think you're 100% right. And I don't think it's exceptionally likely. Though I don't want to rule anything out because I think the desire would certainly be there on the Knicks' part. And I think there are maybe a couple of teams in the NBA who I would argue foolishly think there's some utility left in Kanter and he could be a useful player on a good team.
Yeah, the weirdest one to me, that like the weirdest scenario that I can maybe see playing out, and don't ask me why I could see this playing out, I could just see Vlade Divac falling in love with him and trading, because Sacramento has a number of expiring contracts. Shout out to Iman Shumpert. So I could maybe see them being like the one team that would take him. And I don't know why I have that sentiment, but I just feel like they could be. It might not even net the Knicks anything back other than just players that they don't feel like they have to play anymore. Like Shumpert or others. So yeah, that's kind of my thought on it. I don't know. I don't think it's exceptionally likely. I am thinking that he'll probably reach a buyout sometime either right before or right after the trade deadline, if I had to make a guess.
Yeah, I think that would be maybe the Kingsiest move of all time, when for the first time in over a decade, they finally have some momentum and they're doing it by playing this fast-paced, three-point shooting-oriented basketball, and then they bring in the antithesis of all of that in Enes Kanter. I'm not, and for that reason, I think it's actually maybe even more likely than we're saying, because it would just be the very Kings thing to do, which is rich probably coming from a Knicks fan, but I think that would be extremely funny. All right, question two comes from Anthony D at Anthony D 80 on Twitter. I think we had an 809 in the first part, and now we have an Anthony D 80 coming off an 08. A lot of 8-0s going on. No, don't want to look too much into it, but it's intriguing. All right, I think this is one of my favorite questions that we're going to go through in this part of the podcast. He asks, can Kristaps Porzingis and Kevin Knox rebound and defend well enough to form a closing front court pairing on a great team? Assume requisite support, which I would guess is like maybe guys like Vonleh or Mitchell Robinson or another big that could kind of rotate in there with them. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on that, Alex. I think, again, it's an extremely astute question, just given the fact that offensively, that would be your ideal closing lineup, having that level of shooting, and at least in terms of Knox off the dribble juice at the 4 and 5 would be, I think, very, very hard to stop as those two guys continue to mature. But I'm not sure if it's sustainable defensively, so I'm interested to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think so. I'm only really concerned about one aspect of that question, to be totally honest, and that's the rebounding. As far as defense, I think they could. It's probably assuming a little much about Knox right now, because like the defensive metrics don't grade Knox very well on defense right now. The eye test does not grade Knox very well on defense right now. But he's been put in a position where he's mostly defending small forwards right now, which maybe won't be the ideal spot for him in the future, especially because it just came out this week that he's apparently still growing. So he came into the league at like 6'9". So maybe he's 6'10" now, something like that. So if he gets bigger like that and he has a frame that looks like it can fill out, I think he could realistically be a long-term four and, you know, keep up with power forwards then. Because, you know, power forwards, even in the modern NBA, still aren't, you know, they're not as fast or as, you know, slashing prone as the wings in the league. So defense wise, with Knox bulking up a little bit, which is predictable, like it should happen because he's so young and he's built right for it, I think he'd be able to hold his own on defense. The only thing that worries me a little bit is rebounding, mostly because of Porzingis, not because of Knox. Because Porzingis, you know, is already going to be a fantastic defender inside, and that's why I feel confident enough with Knox to say that they'd be okay in that regard, because Porzingis is like otherworldly on defense. But Porzingis, I mentioned it in the last show about Vonleh and wanting to bring Vonleh back. Porzingis is not a very strong rebounder, and he's shown in his career that he kind of needs a strong rebounding presence next to him to be at his best. So I think that I don't know for sure that Knox is that guy. Knox has shown a little more rebounding ability in this first season than I thought he would, to be totally honest. Like, I didn't think he was going to be rebounding much at all. And he's averaging four and a half a game right now, which still isn't a great number. But it's been trending up lately. So I don't know. That gives me a little bit of pause. I kind of am leaning towards no. I don't know that they would be a good enough rebounding tandem to not just get annihilated in there and need some help in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because with the direction the NBA is going, I guess the flip side of that is can another team punish you necessarily for not having that rebounding on the floor? Maybe if you're in a series against the Sixers, that's a really significant issue because you need someone who can box out Joel Embiid and you can't let him just body you play after play after play. And I think there are a number of interesting ways around that. The Knicks, at least currently, like who knows where they're going to go long-term at those spots, but they have really good size at the point guard position. And guys like Frank Ntilikina, Emmanuel Mudiay could potentially contribute to those efforts. Or alternatively, what I think their long-term starting lineup could be, again, pending getting a Kevin Durant type of free agent. You can, I think, reasonably play Mitchell Robinson with those two guys and close with that kind of lineup just because of the shooting that Knox and Porzingis provide. It would be kind of ideal for someone like Robinson as a rim runner to have ideal spacing. And I think with those five out there, you could put together a credible end of game offense. I just think you're kind of capping your ceiling a little bit on the offensive end of the floor by not having five shooters out there. And I think you made a good point that Knox is highly likely to be a better defender of power forwards than centers long-term, though you don't know how his lateral quickness continues to improve. And with his overall length, he could turn into, at the very least, a decent defender at the small forward position. So I think there's still a lot of variables out there, but I genuinely think that's a great question. And it's honestly, it's one of the biggest things to watch if you're a Knicks fan over the next couple of seasons.
Well, and it's definitely one of those things that can kind of keep you up at night, too, because there's these like idealized versions of what these guys should be in our heads right now. And with the way the roster is currently constructed, I don't know that they necessarily all mesh together if they all reach their theoretical ceilings of, you know, what we realistically think they could be. You know, that's the toughest part about all this like young player roster building, is that sometimes you get all these good pieces, but then they might not necessarily all fit together like the perfect puzzle you thought they could. And we might run into something like that in the future where, you know, it becomes where it would make more sense to play Knox with Porzingis, but they get killed on rebounding. So then you have to play them with Mitch, but then, you know, Mitch isn't good enough on offense to, you know, keep that lineup where it needs to be, combined with Knox not being able to defend threes. It's just, it's a whole thing. I guess it's good problems to have if they all end up being good enough that you want to play them all, but it's still, you know, it's a little worrisome. You know, it's not the end of the world or anything, but it's things to think about as we go forward here with this rebuilding team.
Yeah, I guess the one thing I'd say on that is there are two kind of great solves to that on either end of the floor, and I think offensively it's shooting, and Porzingis is I think proven himself to be incredibly at least good to very good 3-point shooter in the NBA, and Knox is looking like he could be heading that direction. Obviously, you need to see more from him, and you need to see how he continues to improve over the course of his career. But if those two guys are both 38, 39, 40-plus percent 3-point shooters, that just makes things immensely easy. And to me, like, that's always the funny part about when people try and compare the Heat and the Warriors in terms of super teams coming together. And obviously, the Knicks are far from being in those conversations at this point. But the difference between those two always was the fact that the Warriors fit together flawlessly because every single guy on the floor can shoot, and that, like, whatever other concerns you have, that tends to make things relatively seamless. And the Heat didn't have that, so there were these whole load of other concerns and ways to defend them that just aren't available to a team playing the Warriors. And then defensively, if you have rim protection, I think that covers up for a lot. And I think between KP and Mitchell Robinson, you figure out a way to play those two together. I think that solves a lot of other problems. And to me, at least, it's those three guys and the potential combinations, permanent permutations of those three guys that really make me bullish on the Knicks' future going forward. But we've spent a whole ton of time on this question. I think we're going to go to a break, come back, and then we are getting into, I think, maybe my favorite question in the mailbag, because I love the draft. I love redrafting. I love retroactively debating the draft, even just a couple of months after it. You guessed it. We were talking about the draft. We're going to tell you where each of the Knicks' three picks in the 2018-19 draft would go in a redraft next on Locked On Knicks. Thanks for sticking with us on Locked On Knicks, your favorite sort of daily Knicks podcast. Again, Gavin Shaw, Alex Wolf with you. I neglected to mention it at the beginning, so I'll slip it in now. You can follow us on Twitter at Locked On Knicks. And as always, we really encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes. If you get the chance, you can give us 5 stars. You can say anything mean you want to say in the comments, and just give us those 5 stars. Okay, let's get into it. Redrafting the 2018-19 NBA draft. So I'll give you the first crack at this, Alex, but I will say I went pretty deep. I drafted just about everyone up to the point that I got all three Knicks in there. And it took, slight spoiler alert, it took 17 picks for me to do that. So I'll let you get started, but I'll give you that context to work with it.
Okay. All right. Well, so whenever I look at these things, I always just try to look at, you know, you've got this guy. So let's say Kevin Knox first, because he was the first guy that the Knicks took. So you've got Knox. He went at number 9. So then you look at all the guys ahead of him and then a few guys below him. When I'm looking to see if there's anybody below him that I think could realistically be drafted ahead of him, I think the only guy you can really make a case for is maybe Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, his former teammate. But I think given Knox's position and the relative rarity of scoring wings in the league, you know, that's sort of a premium position, I think Knox would still stay ahead of Shai. So I would not say that anybody would leapfrog Knox. Then as far as who Knox would leapfrog, I think you can definitely say Bagley. I think you can definitely say Bamba at this point. Not to say that Bamba's, you know, Bamba was kind of a project to begin with, but Bamba's not exactly lighting the world on fire right now early in this year. I think you could probably say Sexton. but that might just be me. That's probably subjective. I don't know. Sexton's actually having a pretty good year. Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of tough to say. It's probably me being a homer, but I would probably take him again just because of, I would say that they're operating on roughly equal territory as far as play goes, but I think Knox's position is a little more of a premium. And then, I don't know. I struggle with Trae Young. I still think Trae Young would probably go ahead of Knox, even though his shooting splits have been just terrible, just because he brings the assist to the floor and all that. And I do think that Trae Young would probably stay ahead. So if I'm doing it over again, I'd probably say Ayton, if we'll just keep them in order just for whatever's sake. I didn't go through and completely rewrite the draft. I would say I'd probably go Ayton, Doncic, Jackson, Trae Young would still stay there, Wendell Carter, and then Kevin Knox. So that would put me at, he would move up three spots. Or wait. Yeah, he would be at the sixth spot. That's where I would have Kevin Knox right now.
Okay, that's you. I did it. I guess my process to get there was very different, but I was pretty similar. I did the full redraft just because I love doing this, and I would have, even if we didn't have a podcast, I probably would have spent my Sunday mornings just doing this for fun, because that's just the kind of weirdo I am. I had so total redraft. All right, I think Luka Doncic, pretty obvious number one pick. I mean, there's no one close to him. I had Jaren Jackson going second in my redraft, and that hurts me as a man who can proudly say the Phoenix Suns are my second favorite team. But he, just the utility he provides on both ends of the floor. And I just think, as dominant as DeAndre Ayton has been offensively this season, I genuinely think Ayton, by the prime of his career, is going to be a top five, top 10 guy offensively in the NBA. I just think the utility Jackson provides on both ends, and the fact that as a teenager, he's already fairly dominant as a rim protector and can shoot the three, makes me just highly bullish on his future. And I think he's kind of the ideal modern five in a way so few guys across the league are. And I think it's interesting that I think there will be a credible comparison between him and Kristaps Porzingis if you look a little bit down the road. And I'm kind of intrigued to see which of those two ends up having a better career. Three, I had DeAndre Ayton, just because, again, the overwhelming offensive talent. I mean, you've seen a number of games from him as a teenager where he is just the most dominant player on the floor. And then I had Kevin Knox at fourth. And I think you can even make a case with him versus Ayton and him versus Jackson, though I don't think it's a very good one at this point. But just the way he's played over the last month and the variety he's shown in his offensive game is just, and I've said this a million times in the podcast, so I won't harp on it, is just so far ahead of where I thought he would be. And Alex, I don't know if you knew this, but he's only 19 years old. So that also makes me really excited about him.
Kevin Knox is only 19 years old?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is insane.
Okay, I'll keep going, and then when we get to I'm just gonna keep rolling on this, and when we get to the next Nick, I'll give it back to you, and you can let me know where you agree or disagree. All right, okay. I had Trae Young at fifth. Again, I mean, some of the stats are just incredibly ugly, as you mentioned, but the transcendent shooting, I do think he is going to be similar to, I guess, Ayton, like maybe not a top 10 player offensively in the NBA, but a top 5 or 10 passer in the NBA. At the height of his powers. So I just think the flash skills are so overwhelming with him. I want to give him a little bit more time to figure it out on both ends. But I'm kind of banking on upside there, because if you just told me who I thought straight up would have a better career, I'd probably lean Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, just because of how far advanced he is already defensively and in the mid-range game. I had Bagley at seventh. I had Mo Bamba at eighth. I had Wendell Carter Jr., who he's kind of similar to Bamba and Bagley versus the SGA trade debate, where I think he's clearly the better player right now. And there's a good chance he has a better career, but I think he just lacks the upside of a Bagley or a Bamba. And then here's the first shocker. I have Mitchell Robinson at number 10 in my redraft. So do with that what you will.
Yeah, I don't even think that's that big of a shocker, to be honest with you. I mean, I think, I don't know if I necessarily can... Like I said, I didn't spend as much time, you know, actually doing the full-on redraft as you did, but I definitely think that Robinson is a lottery pick in a redraft, because the defensive potential that he's shown is just insane. I mean, he's shown, it seems a little bit presumptuous to say this, but I think he's shown potential defensive player of the year potential right now. You know, he looks like a guy that could win that award at some point in his career once he figures out how to play defense at the NBA level without fouling, because that's kind of his biggest Achilles heel at the moment. But his timing on blocks is phenomenal. His range on blocks is just like unseen. I don't know if I've ever seen it like that before, where he can start from, you know, 8 to 9 feet away from someone shooting a three-pointer and within 1.5 seconds be on top of them and blocking their shot into the third row. It's just kind of insane, his timing and his ability on defense. And then I think with him, the offense will come at some point. Like his inside shooting is, you know, incredible. And I think he's shown at least in practice that he might have a three-point game at some point. If he ever develops even just like a 30% three-point shot where he takes one attempt per game, that'll be enough to keep teams honest. And his inside scoring ability is just like off the charts. Like he's led all rookies in, I believe it's true shooting percentage and maybe also effective field goal percentage for pretty much the whole year, because he just shoots such a high percentage and is so talented with catching those lobs around the rim and all those other things that we've grown to love with him over these first few months of his NBA career. And to kind of have a he's only 19 thing with Mitchell Robinson, he's only been playing, you know, high level organized basketball for 4 months if you count training camp. So that's also pretty crazy, because he jumped from high school, took a year off, and then came to the NBA. So I think if teams had tape of what he's done so far in the NBA, he's a lottery pick for sure. I would put him top 12, 13. For sure is where I'd say you've got him at 10. So I think we're pretty much on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, I think in my heart of hearts, I wanted to put him like 6 or 7. But I mean, just obviously offensively, he can't really match the production of what Bagley and Wendell Carter Jr. have done so far. And Bamba, I guess I have ahead of him just because I mean, he's clearly the better three-point shooter of the two, even though I don't think he'll necessarily ever have the defensive instincts and timing of Robinson. I think that's an underrated part of Robinson's game, just how the amount of times he chooses correctly in terms of what to do in a pick and roll and when to help and when to lean a certain direction is so extraordinarily advanced given his relative experience. And you watch him and you watch someone like Ayton, and it's funny because on both ends of the floor, it's like they're playing different sports. Like what Ayton can do offensively, Mitchell Robinson can't even comprehend it. But I think the same thing is true on the defensive end of the floor with Robinson's utility and his speed and his instincts. Like if you gave those to Ayton, you would have one of the top, you'd have someone who looked like they were going to be a top five center all time and a surefire Hall of Famer. So I cannot say enough good things about Mitchell Robinson. I'm kind of convinced I have him too low at 10, but I'll deal with that for now. Okay, I'll get us up to Trier. So I had Sexton at 11, and I really don't like Colin Sexton as a player. I mean, I get the appeal. I mean, to me, he's going to top out as just kind of an average point guard. Like I don't think the shooting or the instincts are there. Like he just plays a brand of basketball that is not my cup of tea, I guess is the nicest way to say it. But I guess I get why people think he's going to be really good. So I have him at 11.
For what it's worth, what it's worth on Sexton, I totally concur. And I was super low on him before the draft. And I actually I screamed and cheered when the Cavs took him one pick ahead of the Knicks, because I was convinced that that was saving the Knicks from themselves, because I really thought that they were thinking about taking him, and I did not like him a bit.
Yeah. I had the exact same reaction. So even before the podcast started, we were on the same page. I had Michael Porter Jr. at 12. I don't know. That's just kind of throw my hands up. Yeah. Whatever. I had 13, a shocker here and a little bit of a Nets homer pick maybe, but I had Rodions Karutz at 13, who has been killing it for the Nets and is somehow been an efficient scorer and a part-time starter as a 20-year-old who didn't even really get to play in Europe last year. He's a guy whose upside I love, and I think he's a real sleeper in this draft. So I had him there. I had Kevin Huerter at 14. I just love his shooting. I think he's going to be really, really good. Miles Bridges, who I don't like that much, but he's just such a good athlete, I threw him a bone at 15. Mikal Bridges at 16, just because defensively he's actually already like a top 10 wing in the NBA, and I think the shooting will come around with him. And then I initially had Trier at 17, but, and this is funny given what we just talked about, but I totally forgot to put Sexton in there because that's how much I irrationally hate him. So I slid Sexton at 11, and that pushed Landry Shamet back one spot to 17. And I think Shamet versus Trier is kind of an interesting conversation given both have had obvious utility in their rookie years. I just give Shamet a little bit of an advantage because he's doing it on a playoff team in kind of win or lose, like high intensity situations, while Trier doesn't really have that pressure. I mean, working on this Knicks team that has just sucked all year. And I kind of default to shooting over all else when I'm evaluating guards. And I think Shamet is a slightly better shooter than Trier. So that is my defense for that. But if you want to put Trier a little bit higher, a little bit lower, I'm okay with it. But just given his age and then conversely, given what he's shown so far, I think around 18 is a pretty good spot for Alonzo Trier.
Yeah, that's probably about where I'd have him as well. I think the teams would look at Trier at this point and realize, you know, just how valuable of a skill he has for them, which is, you know, that ISO scoring ability that's so hard to come by. You know, it's one of those skills that, like, if you need it late in the game, it's like the most valuable thing that you could ever have is just like one-on-one shot creation, because sometimes teams just really ratchet that defensive pressure up, especially in a high pressure game. And there's just no getting your offense off. You know, you just kind of need to rely on your guy being better than the other guy getting to the hoop. And Trier definitely has that. He has his deficiencies too. You know, I think he gets tunnel vision a little too often. When he's looking to distribute, he's great. I think he actually, he's not like a, you know, crazy, crazy good point guard that has like fantastic vision, but he can get the job done, run a couple pick and rolls for you and find guys out of pick and roll and things of that nature. So I think he's got those valuable NBA skills. The thing that I think would hold him back, you know, if Trier was like 19 years old, say, going into a draft, you know, he would have, I would have him way higher on this list, because you would think like, oh, we're going to be able to do so much more with him. You know, he could definitely show tons of growth as a player, this, that, the other. As it stands, you know, he's what, 20, he's 22 years old now, almost 23. And so, you know, I don't think that he would get drafted much higher than that just off his age, because teams would look at him and say, okay, you know, he's probably about what he's going to be now, which is still a valuable player. But, you know, I don't know how much growth he's going to show versus if he was, you know, only 19 years old, like Kevin Knox, who's only 19.
That's a perfect way to finish up this segment. All right, we will come back a quick third segment next on Locked On Knicks. Talking about Knox and Burke versus Vonleh and Trier, are the Knicks tanking, and of course the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That next on Locked On Knicks.
And welcome back. We're back on Locked On Knicks. So we're tackling our last few mailbag questions here. So this first question is from Stingy, who's my buddy Jonathan Schulman from Posting and Toasting. His handle on Twitter is at ilough, T-H-O, not T-H-O-U-G-H. His question, or he phrased it like a statement, but I'll read it as a question. You can only have one, Knox and Burke or Vonleh and Trier, pick. So the way that I read this is like as if it is today, like all the contract situations are the same, all that. Am I right in probably assuming that?
Oh, I was looking at it. I interpreted it completely differently, which I guess is why I thought it was easy. I was looking at it like long term. So I think, so you're saying like one to win one game, who would I pick between these?
Oh, no. I'm saying like for long term, but like their contract situations are as they are today. So it's not like, oh, you can re-sign Vonleh on a cheap deal, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, Vonleh's still on a 1-year deal. Trier is still on his 2-year biannual exception. Knox rookie deal, and Burke on a 1-year minimum contract.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So my thought, and this would not have been so easy just a few weeks ago, but now it's like a home run. I would take Knox and Burke. I think it essentially boils down to, do you want Knox or do you want Vonleh and Trier? Because Burke, I don't even think factors into the equation anymore. So I would just say Knox, period. I would take Knox over those other two, and it's not really that close to me anymore. I think Knox is really looking like a player that could be potentially an all-star somewhere down the line, but at the very least, Knox is a starter on an NBA team who can score the damn basketball, and he's really good. Like I would feel extremely foolish taking, even as much as I love Vonleh and as much as I like Trier, I'd feel completely foolish not taking Knox in that situation.
Yeah, I think you can put out any variation of this question that you want. If the group that's not Knox's group doesn't include Porzingis, I would always take the group with Knox, no matter how unappealing it is. Like, if you told me, like, Knox and Enes Kanter versus, I don't know, like, Vonleh, Moutier, Trier, and Frank, like, I would lean Knox. And I think, like, you could push this question to more uncomfortable limits. Like, you could say, like, Knox versus Frank, Moutier, Dotson, Trier, like, every valuable other young guy that Knicks have, and, like, maybe even put Robinson in there. And then maybe it starts to get interesting, but you would have to stack the other group in such an overwhelming way for me not to pick the group with Kevin Knox in it. Because again, I'm 100% with you. We did a whole episode putting odds on what percentage we saw the Knicks players being all stars down the road. And I was of the opinion Knox was above 50% to be an all star for his career. And I'm not all that close to saying that about anyone else on the roster outside of obviously KP. So I think this one is super easy, and I don't think we have to talk about it too much more. All right, second question from Father of Katie at Father of Katie. Shout out to Katie, shout out to her dad. First things first, do you think Knicks are tanking? First few weeks, they played much better team ball than now. I hope they are tanking, or they are just getting worse. Smiling, crying emoji. I don't know. I mean, I mean, what do you want to call tanking? Do you want to say building a roster full of young guys with vets that can't play defense? Do you want to call that tanking? Because that's tanking. I don't think they are consciously trying to lose games, but I think they put together a roster that does not have to consciously try to lose games because they are already pretty bad. And I guess some people would interpret them benching Kanter and playing him less minutes as a form of tanking. I would say anyone who's even given like a cursory look into the underlying analytics of Enes Kanter would tell you that that is actually a move to win more games. So, Alex, I'm interested to hear your opinion on that, though. I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah, I don't think they're actively tanking. I don't know. I mean, because if they were actively tanking, I feel like you would have Fizdale being more patient with certain guys, i.e. Frank, you know, as far as like, if Frank's out there and he's stinking it up, you would just leave him out there and let him stink it up, you know, like let him figure it out as he goes. And I think Fizdale legitimately is trying to win games just based off of that alone. And the fact that he's, you know, for one reason or another been, you know, yielding to the wishes, I guess, of some of the veterans like Kanter and still playing them a lot of minutes. I guess you could say he hasn't been doing that for pretty much any of the other veterans necessarily, like Hazonia, who's sort of a vet, Lance, Courtney Lee. I mean, he hasn't been playing them as much, but I mean, I guess they don't complain as much as Kanter does about that stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think they're actively tanking. And I do think, you know, counter to what Father of Katie said here, I'd love to know what his name is. I just know his daughter's name is Katie.
That might be a legal name. We can't rule that out.
We can't rule it out. Yeah. but I do think that counter to what he said, I don't know that they've necessarily, like, they've been losing more games, but a lot of times I feel better about what I'm seeing from the team lately than, you know, necessarily even at the beginning of the season when they were winning a few more games than we thought they would. So, you know, it's all about looking at things through like microcosms rather than looking at big picture stuff right now, because the reality is that Fizdale is still acknowledged, you know, that he's essentially just experimenting, you know, through the rest of this year. So he keeps trying new things and putting new players out there, trying to find these, you know, magical combos that are going to work, somehow neglecting some of the ones that actually did work, like that starting lineup that he ditched. That was a plus 8.5 or whatever it was in net rating, but we won't get into that right now. But no, to wrap it all up, I don't think they're actively tanking. I don't think they're literally going out every time out and being like, yes, let's lose this game.
Yeah, and I think it will be interesting to see if that shifts as the season goes on. And I think, because I am more of the school of thought that they should be letting someone like Frank Ntilikina kind of work through his mistakes. And especially when they're, if you're going to be losing 8 games in a row anyways, why not allow that to happen? But maybe that's just me. All right. We have gotten through all the bullshit we've talked about. We've talked about your dumb Knicks questions. None of it really matters. What does matter is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I thank Alex at Cat's Caves PDX for acknowledging that. He asks, or she asks, Alex.
It's a he.
Alex, my guy. What's the official Locked On Knicks stance? It's kind of an ambiguous name. What's the official Locked On Knicks stance on the Marvel Cinematic Universe? I got ahead of myself. I got too excited. I forgot that we were doing a mailbag on this, and I answered that question on Twitter, and I want to make it very clear because I said this on Twitter, but I'll make it here. Mailbag episode or no mailbag episode, you have any topics you want us to discuss in either the MCU, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones? I'm not all that well versed on Lord of the Rings, but I will do my darndest. Anything you want on that, I will drop everything basketball related, and I will talk about that because at the end of the day, it is ultimately my priority. So I love the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm very excited for the culmination of it in the next couple of months, and I don't know. I'd love to get into specifics, Alex, if you ever have anything for us.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I totally concur. First off, shouts to Alex, who's like a really long time listener of the show. He's from Portland, which is the PDX in his handle. And this dude, like, he's like a Trailblazers fan, but he loved James so much that he used to listen to the show. And now he loves us so much that he still listens to the show. So I'm very flattered by Alex. He's a fan from very far away. Yeah, so I'm currently answering this question with two middle fingers pointed towards San Francisco, where James Marcito lives now, because this was like the only thing that James would never let me talk about is comic book stuff. And I'm so glad to hear that you are totally on board with it, because I freaking love the MCU. And as you were saying, I love all the nerdy shit. And James looked at it as like, oh, like that's all for kids. And I'm like, James. It's not for kids. You know, $2 billion says that it's not just for kids. So I am totally into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I would be happy to. I think we should honestly do an episode where we relate all of the Knicks players to Marvel superheroes at some point, because I think that would be dope. Yeah. We could also do it where we relate them to characters from any number of other nerdy things. And I want to do as many as possible. And then I want to like strap James to a chair and make him listen to them. And then I also want them to do really good with ratings and stuff so that we can shove it in his face.
Yeah. And we can maybe push it throughout the Locked On Podcast Network that this is the way to generate listens. But you know what? I'm looking at that month of April. Game of Thrones comes back. In addition to that, the final Avengers movie, Avengers Endgame, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, we don't necessarily know if it's the final one, because they're, you know, it's presumably the final one for some of the Avengers, because there's a lot of speculation that some of the characters are going to die.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's probably going to be more Avengers. They're going to make, like, the new Avengers after that, you know, or it's going to have future Black Panther more, probably, Doctor Strange, guys like that, you know, and you might get, like, so... my theory, personally, is that they're definitely going to kill Captain America because Chris Evans already spoiled that, which is kind of a bummer because he put out that tweet of saying, like, just wrapped up my final day filming on a Marvel set ever, and then tried to walk it back and be like, no, I just meant for this movie. It's like, no, you knew what you were saying. You're dead. Your character's dead. And I also think they're going to kill Tony Stark. So it'll be interesting to see who they make the new Captain America and who they make the new Iron Man, if one at all. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that is both painful, and I 100% agree with you on those points. All right, so we're killing Avengers. We're killing this podcast. It has been a joy. Two mailbags. This one, we tried to avoid having an extra long podcast by splitting it into two parts. And this one is going to run right around 40 minutes. So I hope you guys had plenty of time on your hands on this Monday or Tuesday morning, depending on when I decided to put this out. I'm glad you were along for the ride with us. Again, this is certainly a topic that is we're willing to dive into at any point, anytime, anywhere. For Alex, I'm Gavin. Enjoy the rest of your week. We will be back. We know we have a couple of games to catch up on as well. Until then, be good.